The Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Death was once the standard punishment in America, even for nonviolent crimes like burglary and counterfeiting, and few judged the law too severe. For the past half century, however, the death penalty has been the subject of some of our most bitter debates. Whether phrased in philosophical, political, or economic terms, the arguments have been rooted in two basic moral questions. Are there any crimes so grave, or any criminals so evil, that death is the only just punishment? And is it right for the state, acting in our name, to put criminals to death? One way to approach answers to these questions is to look at the history of the death penalty in the United States, which is what we'll be doing this week with the author of a new book on the subject, Stuart Banner. After that, we mark the 100th anniversary of the founding of the city of Las Vegas with a commentary by Jeff Schumacher, the author of A History of Las Vegas, and with Fiona Beatty's Site of the Week, where you can join in on the centennial celebration. But first, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. This week, related to our major topic, the death penalty. Anne Boleyn's execution is among the best known in history. But if George Melville Jackson has his way, she may be pardoned for her alleged crimes some 500 years after she lost her head. According to a news report out of London, Melville Jackson has petitioned Britain's Home Secretary, Charles Clark, to pardon Henry VIII's second wife because she was innocent of the crimes of adultery, incest, and witchcraft that led to her beheading in 1536. Melville Jackson also wants Anne Boleyn's remains to be moved from the Tower of London to Westminster Abbey to lie alongside those of her daughter, Queen Elizabeth I. Ideally, I would like her to be declared not guilty of the crimes she was convicted of, Melville Jackson commented. A pardon only means that she's being excused for those crimes. But I got a barrister's opinion, and it seems that we would not be able to go to court to get a judicial review because after 500 years, there's not much of a chance of being able to come up with new evidence. So a pardon is the next best thing. In his petition, Melville Jackson cites the work of historians like Simon Schama and Lady Antonia Fraser, but the British Home Office is yet to comment. And setting the stage for our interview, according to a recent Justice Department report, the number of persons sentenced to death has reached a 30-year low. And based on statistics from 2003, the death row population fell for the third year in a row as well. 144 inmates in 25 states were given the death penalty in 2003, 24 fewer than in 2002, and less than half the average of 297 between 1994 and 2000. Death penalty opponents said the report showed how wary the public is of executions, heightened by concerns about whether the punishment is administered fairly, and publicity about those wrongly convicted. Nationally, 267 persons were removed from death row in 2003, and that was the largest drop since 1976 when the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty. We'll add some historical perspective on this in a moment with our guest, Stuart Banner. This is Talking History. Americans pride themselves on their commitment to human rights, but the United States is virtually alone among Western nations in putting criminals to death. And in some parts of the world, America's use of capital punishment is considered inconsistent with human rights. The death penalty is intended in part to deter others from committing crimes, but we inflict it in private. It is often justified in retributive terms, and yet we take great care to make it as painless as possible. We can resolve these apparent paradoxes only by looking back at how they came to exist. So writes our guest this week, Stuart Banner, in his new book, The Death Penalty and American History. Banner is a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome, Stuart.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's follow your lead here and seek some answers to these paradoxes you've identified. You begin your book by noting that the English colonists of North America inherited the death penalty from the mother country, but then they tempered it, or at least limited those liable to execution. Explain this a bit.
Yeah, that's right. England in the 17th and 18th centuries had a very long list of capital crimes. Almost every serious crime was punished with death. But in America, the northern colonies were less strict, especially for property offenses. So crimes like burglary and robbery, for example, weren't capital offenses in some of the northern colonies. And that's probably because property was distributed much more evenly in the colonies than in England, so elites perceived less of a need for strict punishments. In the southern colonies, though, where the pattern of wealth distribution was closer to that of England, colonial governments simply copied English law, so the southern colonies had many more capital offenses than in the north, and that's the origin of a pattern that's remained with us.
Okay. Similarly, in executions in 17th and 18th century America, those were public events. Tell us why this was the case.
Yeah, hangings were huge public events. They were conducted outdoors in big open areas. They attracted crowds of thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people. These were the biggest crowds that colonial Americans knew. The execution itself was just part of a big ceremony involving sermons by ministers, normally a speech by the condemned person. The main rationale for staging hangings in public was that the death penalty would be a more effective deterrent of future crimes if people could actually see it being carried out. And so parents would often bring their kids to impart a lesson about the dangers of crime, and the condemned person would often warn spectators not to follow the path that he had gone down. Today, I think there's a common belief that public hangings were raucous, carnivalesque events, but that probably wasn't true most of the time.
You know, that's interesting because I teach early American history, and whenever I show an execution, whether I'm doing the Salem witch trials or whatever, there's a crowd out there watching. Everyone thinks it's some kind of Hollywood makeup, but it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, it has some reality in history.
In most places, these were unusual events. Several years would pass from one hanging to the next, and so, yeah, everybody would go.
But nevertheless, in the 19th century, public executions came under criticism. Why is that?
Attitudes changed in the 19th century. Most of the states, all the states except for a few southern states, moved their executions out of public spaces and into the jail yard in the 19th century. And it was really a matter of changing polite tastes, really. Respectable people began to think there was something unseemly about putting death on display, about watching an execution. You begin to see arguments in the early 19th century that public hangings will actually make spectators more likely to commit crimes, not less, because it'll habituate them to violence. And again, it's part of a broader change in polite middle-class taste in the 19th century. You see more and more of an interest in etiquette and proper public behavior and the middle class wanting to differentiate themselves from the mob. Part of that is you see an increased interest in taking death out of public view. And so it's around the same time that cemeteries begin moving from crowded urban areas out into the countryside. People begin dying in hospitals rather than in the home, and I think the abolition of public hanging is part of that.
It's interesting, but you also suggest that there's some opposition to the death penalty itself.
That's right. Opposition to the death penalty is something that really starts to gather steam in the late 18th century, and so in the 1790s, a few states abolished capital punishment for crimes other than murder. And in the early 19th century, you start to see more opposition to the death penalty, even for murder. And the question of complete abolition is something that gets regularly taken up by state legislatures, especially in the North. And eventually, in the middle part of the century, three states do abolish capital punishment, even for murder. This was Michigan, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island. And this is an international phenomenon. It takes place all over Europe as well. Really, it's connected to the invention of the prison in the late 18th century, because before the prison, there wasn't much of an alternative to death for serious crimes. But the prison provided the first real alternative, and so people begin arguing that the purposes served by the death penalty will be better served by prison.
So prisons actually do weaken the idea of using the death penalty as a deterrent.
Yeah, once you have prisons, you start getting a lively debate over which is the more effective deterrent, prison or death, and of course that's a debate that's still going on today. Prisons also weaken support for the death penalty in another sense, in that one of the main justifications for the death penalty in the 17th and 18th centuries was that it helped promote the criminal's penitence by forcing him to repent before it was too late. Now, the early prisons were also intended to facilitate penitence, which is why they were called penitentiaries. The idea was that with a long period of isolation, of introspection, criminals would come to repent for their crimes. And so once you have prisons, you get a big debate over which punishment is going to produce more penitence. And that, again, weakens support for the death penalty.
Now, if we look at this period as you define it, from roughly the 1830s to the 1930s, you point to other changes that bring about sort of a redefinition, if you will, of the nature of the public with respect to the death penalty. Let me just list the three one at a time and let you talk about it. First of all, the growth of the press.
Yeah, the penny press, you know, widespread dissemination of newspapers, occurs right around the same time as the abolition of public hanging. And the newspapers, one of the things that they report is hangings in lavish detail. And so even when executions move out of public spaces, there's always room for journalists. And so even though the public can no longer actually go to a hanging, they read about them.
And is this linked to your other point about really paying more attention now to celebrated trials?
Yeah, well, that's right. Trials remain public, even when hangings are no longer public. And so you see enormous amounts of attention paid to murder trials. People pack into courtrooms to watch this. You know, I think it's in part a surrogate for being able to go to hangings.
Interesting. Something we carry with us today. Okay,
yeah.
Talk about the widening of participation in clemency decisions. How can participation in that decision widen?
It's really an artifact as politics grows more democratic over the course of the 19th century, and clemency is a political decision. And so more and more people get involved in clemency petitioning over the 19th century. In the 18th century, it was pretty much local elites who would have influence. But by the mid-19th century, even especially the late 19th century, you start getting these mass petitioning campaigns where hundreds, thousands of people will sign petitions either in favor of clemency or against clemency. You know, I think the sum of all, if you put all this together, over the 19th century, as public hangings are abolished and you get all these replacements for it, the public experience of capital punishment becomes secondhand experience, a reading and writing experience, rather than the immediate physical experience it had been during the days of public executions.
Interesting. Let's talk about methods of execution, because you make a good point, not just saying when they come into use, but the impact they have on attitudes toward the death penalty. Let's start with the electric chair. When did it first come into use and what impact did that have?
The electric chair is invented in the late 1880s. It's first used in New York in 1890. It was a response to a growing concern over several decades that hanging was an unnecessarily painful way of killing someone, and often too gruesome a sight for spectators. Now, some of the early electrocutions turn out to be painful and gruesome as well, but after a few years, it seems pretty clear that on average, the electric chair is less painful and less disgusting to watch than hanging. And so states gradually switch from hanging to the electric chair until by the mid-20th century, more than half the states are conducting electrocutions. And one big effect of that is it makes the ceremony even less public than it had already become. That is, even after hangings are moved into the jail yard, out of public view, there's still room for hundreds of spectators. But electrocutions, you know, obviously have to be, for technical reasons, have to be indoors. They're usually in small rooms deep within the state prison. And so crowd sizes shrink down to about 20 or 30 people at the most. And that's still what the ceremony's like today.
Okay. What about the gas chamber?
Same motive, to reduce the pain and the gruesome display associated with hanging. The gas chamber is first used in Nevada in the 1920s and then spreads to about a quarter of the states, mostly in the West, mostly states that hadn't yet adopted the electric chair. And again, some of the early gas chamber executions, you know, by witness accounts, seem to be very painful and pretty gruesome. But again, the details get worked out after a few years. And on average, it probably was less painful to be executed in the gas chamber than to be hanged. And the gas chamber has the same effect on the ceremony, particularly on the crowd size, as the electric chair had, because gas chambers, again, for technical reasons, have to be indoors. They have to be in specially prepared rooms. And so there's only space for a very small number of spectators.
And what about lethal injection?
Lethal injection's first used in the late 1970s. It's used now in nearly every state that conducts executions. And the same motive is at play. It's this constant desire to minimize the pain and the gruesomeness for the spectators associated with executions. And in every method, there are exceptions, but consensus probably on average is probably less painful, less disgusting than the electric chair or the gas chamber.
You write that during the middle decades of the 20th century, the number of executions declines. But then in 1972, the Supreme Court declares the death penalty unconstitutional, and that puts a halt on things momentarily. But then the states begin to reinstitute the death penalty, and now we're facing an increasing public expression of concern and a decline in the numbers again. So it seems to be a bit of a roller coaster ride going on. We only have a couple minutes, but how would you explain all of this?
Well, to get back to the first part of your question, the number of executions does begin declining in the 1930s, and that's a decline that continues right up till the court declares the death penalty unconstitutional in 1972. And those two things are related. Part of the decline in the execution rate had to do with declining public support for capital punishment, especially among intellectuals, and Supreme Court justices are part of their culture. You know, there were several of the justices in the mid-20th century were opponents of capital punishment. And then part of the decline in the execution rate was caused by Supreme Court decisions in the 1950s and 1960s that recognized new sorts of constitutional rights for criminal defendants. And those decisions paved much of the way for Furman v. Georgia, the 1972 case that declared the death penalty unconstitutional. As for the future, I'm skeptical that knowing the past makes you any better at predicting the future, but I can say that opposition to death penalty has risen and fallen cyclically over time, and if that continues, it's looking like we're starting to see a revival of the sort of opposition that we saw most recently in the 1960s, and that in recent years the execution rate and the death sentence rate have been declining. But it's still true that in polls the death penalty is still very popular, so it's hard to see any kind of fundamental change coming anytime soon.
Do you attribute it to simply the new scientific ways of, you know, DNA tracing and whatever for murders and the doubt that it's casting on some of the convictions?
That's part of it. All these innocent people who keep popping up on death row, I think, are causing some people to have second thoughts about the death penalty. Are you also starting to see state legislatures and then ultimately the Supreme Court starting to nibble away at the class of people eligible for the death penalty? So recently the court held that the mentally retarded can't be executed. This year the court has a case involving whether juveniles can be executed, and so we'll see what happens.
All right. One of those cases comes out of Missouri, and hopefully it'll be decided within the next couple months, and maybe we'll get you back on to comment on it.
That'd be great.
Very good. Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you, Stuart, for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Stuart Banner, professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the author of The Death Penalty, An American History. This is Talking History.
Well, they're building a gallows outside my cell, and I've got 25 minutes to go. And the whole town's waiting just to hear me yell. I got 24 minutes to go. Well, they gave me some beans for my last meal with 23 minutes to go. But nobody asked me how I feel. I got 22 minutes to go. Well, I sent for the governor and the whole darn bunch with 21 minutes to go. And I called up the mayor, but he's out to lunch. I got 20 more minutes to go. Then the sheriff said, boy, I'm gonna watch you die with 19 minutes to go.
Perhaps the title of his book says it all, Sun, Sin, and Suburbia. And as noted earlier, Las Vegas is marking the first 100 years of its history on May 15, 2005. Here to offer us his thoughts on the centennial is the author of An Essential History of Modern Las Vegas, Jeff Schumacher.
Las Vegas is celebrating its centennial this year, and as you might expect, the city is putting on a production worthy of its reputation as the entertainment capital of the world. While the festivities for locals have a homespun flavor, complete with parade and beer-growing contest, the events catering to tourists, set for the 4th of July weekend, promise to be a spectacle. Beyond the neon glare, however, some Las Vegans are debating whether it's right and proper for the city to celebrate its 100th birthday this year. 100 years ago, a railroad was completed from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City, with a halfway point stop in Las Vegas. On May 15, 1905, railroad owner William A. Clark held an auction of lots in a new town site east of the tracks. The auction was heavily advertised in Los Angeles and Salt Lake City, spurring 3,000 people to travel to this dusty outpost to bid on a promising piece of the desert. That auction, city officials argue, marked the birth of Las Vegas. But while the land auction was a major turning point for the city, history buffs can make a case for several other birth dates. For example, it might have been more appropriate for Las Vegas to have celebrated its centennial last year. The original Las Vegas town site, created by surveyor J.T. McWilliams, sprouted in 1904, just west of where the railroad tracks were to be built. But after Clark's auction, the McWilliams town site was all but deserted and eventually became the segregated black part of town. The city also is likely to hold a party in 2011, 100 years after Las Vegas incorporated. Yet another line of thinking holds that 2005 is more properly Las Vegas' sesquicentennial, since Mormon church leader Brigham Young dispatched a small group of followers to settle here in 1855. A remnant of the fort the Mormon settlers built still stands near downtown Las Vegas. Of course, some argue that Las Vegas didn't have a whole lot to talk about until 1931, when the struggling town's fortunes brightened with the construction of Hoover Dam and the state's legalization of gambling. Count on another big celebration in 2031. The truth is, the Las Vegas Centennial is an excuse to hold a party, and only the dourest souls can complain about that.
You've been listening to Jeff Schumacher, journalist, freelance writer, and the author of Sun, Sin, and Suburbia, An Essential History of Modern Las Vegas.
Bright light city, gonna set my soul, gonna set my soul on fire. Got a whole lot of money that's ready to burn, so get those stakes up higher. There's a thousand pretty women waiting out there. They're all living the devil may care, and I am just a devil with love to spare. So viva Las Vegas, viva Las Vegas. How I wish that there were more than the 24 hours in the day. Even if there were 40 more, I wouldn't sleep a minute away. Oh, there's blackjack and poker and the roulette wheel, a fortune won and lost on every deal. All you need is a strong heart and a new steel. Viva Las Vegas!
And finally, in the event you wish to join in on the centennial festivities in Las Vegas, Fiona Beattie will tell you where you might start.
Las Vegas, home of glitz, dazzle, wedding chapels, saloons and casinos, is celebrating its centennial in typical style with parades and parties. But that's not all. Visitors can delve deeper into the past 100 years of its history at the Clark County Museum's exhibition From Whistlestop to Windfall, 100 Years in Las Vegas. Literally a whistlestop, Las Vegas began as a small railroad town with a concentration of saloons in one block. When the railroad restricted sale of liquor to Block 16 at a public auction of lots on May 15, 1905, and so the infamous Red Light District began. Visitors to the exhibition can get the flavor of a frontier town when they enter through 1905 Tent Saloon. From there, they pass through recreated scenes from early railroad days to the present, with sections on hotels, education, and law enforcement. For those interested in the wedding industry, there's even a model wedding chapel. But it is, after all, people who make a town, and visitors can vote for their favorite individual, such as Anna Roberts Parks, the town's first female funeral parlor owner. There's an introduction to the history of El Dorado, originally a rodeo with parades by old and young alike, and a whisker-growing contest. And for those, like me, who may be puzzled by what a whisker-growing contest entails, you can attend the revived El Dorado in May, but there won't be a rodeo. To find out more about the Clark County Museum exhibition From Whistlestop to Windfall, or to learn more about Las Vegas' celebration of its first 100 years, visit www.lasvegas2005.org.
Not unusual to be loved by anyone.
not unusual to have fun with anyone. But when I see you hanging about with anyone, it's not unusual to see me cry. I wanna die. It's not unusual to go out at any time. But when I see you out and about, it's such a crime. If you should ever wanna be loved by anyone, it's not unusual, it happens every day. No matter what you say, you'll find it happens all the time. Love will never do what you want to do. Why can't this crazy love be
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. And that to learn more about Talking History, all you need to do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu. Or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.